Now, last week I said we would probably have two sessions left, but upon further study, I've decided if you are willing, we're going to try to knock this thing out tonight.
Okay?
Now, on Sunday, Pastor Bill preached 10 chapters of the book of Esther in about 40 minutes, and he told us to keep our seat belts buckled. So I'm saying keep them buckled tonight, but you can loosen them a little. We got five chapters. We got an hour. I think we're going to do just fine. But I'm doing this on purpose because as I was studying Genesis 46 through 50, the way that they work together is so good. And so, you know, last time I used the roller coaster analogy. I said if the story of Joseph is this roller coaster, then chapters 44 and 45 are when you're coming up to the top of that last huge, you know, part of the roller coaster ride. And then we came down a little bit. And so 46 through 50 are, we're coming down and we're going to come into the station, but there's still going to be a twist or a turn that we might not have seen coming. So we're going to work through this tonight. Now, so far, a couple things I've been reiterating this whole time. I want us to understand Joseph's story is a part of the larger story of both Genesis and the whole Bible, right? So Joseph's story is in the larger context. And throughout Genesis, God has continually been making and repeating promises to his people. He keeps making promises, and he keeps reiterating those same promises, saying, I'm going to do this. And we've talked about these promises over and over again. He's promised to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. He's promised them a few things. He's promised them land. I'm going to give you a particular piece of land. He promises them seed, meaning you're going to have many, many descendants, as numerous as the stars in the heaven. And he promises them blessing. I'm going to bless you and your descendants, and anyone who blesses you, I will bless. And so we've already seen these themes kind of weaving in and out of Joseph's story, and they're going to be all over it tonight. As everything comes to a close in Genesis, they're all over it. So keep your eyes and ears peeled as we go through. Now, catch you up on Joseph's story if you haven't been here or if you just need a reminder. Joseph, he's the son of Jacob. Jacob's got 12 sons. Joseph is the son of his favored wife, Rachel. So he's the favored son, but I said he's favored but forsaken because the brothers hate him for his favor, and therefore they sell him into slavery. And we said last time that kind of the first half of Joseph's story, we can almost call it, it's God's testing of Joseph. Joseph's tested in many ways. He's tested with Potiphar. He's tested in prison. And then he's tested when he goes to the palace to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. And then we got into, okay, well, if Joseph's tested and he passes, the brothers are going to have to be tested too. If they're going to be a part of God's plan, they need to be tested as well. And so we saw the story of how they come to Egypt looking for food. They do not recognize their brother. He recognizes them. And so we have this whole back and forth where he tells them, you got to go get your youngest brother Benjamin and bring him here so I know you're not lying. And there's this whole uproar when they get back and they tell their father, we have to take your youngest son with us. And he says, you can't take him. But finally they convince him and they go. And Judah says, if I don't bring him back, I will be held accountable. Right? And so last week we saw Joseph's final testing of them. He puts a silver cup into their bags, into one bag of grain of the brothers. And as they're leaving, they think they're finally out of here. And Joseph's servant catches them on the way, tells them, how dare you steal from the second in command of Egypt? And they say, we haven't stolen anything. If you find that cup in one of our bags, you can kill that man. And they go one by one, and the cup is in Benjamin's bag, the youngest, the one whom Jacob the father said, you have to bring him back. So when they stand back before Joseph, they have nothing they can say, and they can't defend themselves. And Joseph says, Benjamin is staying here. The rest of y'all are free. And this is when Judah finally steps up. And we've seen Judah this whole time. He's had his character arc. He's getting better and better. And he finally steps up. And he has this long monologue we read, and it ends with him saying, I cannot bear to see what would come of my father if we do not come back with Benjamin. Therefore, take me and leave him. Let him go back with his brothers and take me. And Joseph can't handle that. He's overwhelmed by the emotions of what Judah has just done, and so he finally reveals his identity to them. He's been hiding the whole time. He looks very Egyptian. They never even guess he's still alive, and he reveals himself to his brothers, and he tells them that basically he's forgiven them because of what God's done. He's seen God working, and so he's forgiven them. And then we ended last week with Joseph telling these brothers, "You got to go back and get my father. I've been reunited with you all. It's been 20-something years. I've let go of everything. But you now have to go back and get my father, Jacob. I still need to see him. And there's still a famine in the land. So you need to go get them because the famine's going to get worse and worse." So today we're going to pick it up with this final reunion of Joseph and his father, Jacob. And we're going to start in chapter 46 of the book of Genesis. Chapter 46 begins like this. So Israel set out with all that he had. And this says Israel, this is also Jacob, same name. Israel set out with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba. And he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes." So we have an image to show a little bit of like this journey that they're going to go on. And so as Jacob is beginning this journey, you see they're starting around Hebron in the land of Canaan, and his first stop is this place called Beersheba. So as they're going toward Egypt, they stop at Beersheba. This is an interesting location. This is a place where his grandfather Abraham spent time. And Beersheba is a place where his father Isaac lived. And actually, Beersheba is the place that Jacob lived before he had to flee after he deceived his father. So on his way back to Egypt, he stops in Beersheba and offers sacrifices to God. And he's doing this seeking God's will. Because you got to remember, they're in the promised land. They're in the land of Canaan. Now, they don't own anything in it, but they're in the land. And other times that there have been famines, Abraham was allowed to go to Egypt. But guess what? When Isaac said, "There's a famine, I'm going to go to Egypt," God said, "You can't go. Don't go to Egypt." So Jacob is now, he's offering these sacrifices, and he's kind of asking God, "Is this right? I want to go see my son, but are we supposed to be leaving the land?" And God speaks to him. And he comforts him, and he says a few things. He says, "I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt." So God's comforting Jacob. "Do not be afraid, for I will make you a great nation there." Now that's interesting, because this whole time in the book of Genesis, God keeps saying, "I'm going to make you all a great nation." But you don't really know how, and you don't really know where. And now God gets a little more specific. "I will make you a great nation there." When you go to Egypt, of all places. And then he says, "I'll make you a great nation." In verse 4, he says, "I will go down with you to Egypt." So he's now even, he's already extended his protection over Jacob throughout his life, but he's being even more specific. "I'm going to go with you when you go to Egypt." Paul Tripp, he's a pastor and writer, he writes, "Jacob's hope and security has never been in his situation or his location. God had been Jacob's security all along, no matter where he's been." And God's reaffirming that, "I will go down with you." And then he says, "I will surely also bring you up again." Now, the "you" here is Jacob's household. Because you see after this, he says, "Joseph, your son's going to close your eyes." So he's saying, "You're going to die. You are going to die in Egypt. But I will bring your household back out of Egypt." And that's going to be important as we're thinking about these promises, land, seed, and blessing. Land. He's leaving the land, but God is promising, "I'm going to bring you back to the land." Okay, and we continue here. So in verse 5, it says, "Then Jacob arose from Beersheba." So we see Beersheba. And the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry them. Remember last time we learned Pharaoh literally sent wagons down to Egypt. We said these are not the same make and model as those ones in Canaan. These are those Egyptian wagons. And so they took their livestock and their property which they acquired in the land of Canaan, and they came to Egypt. Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now this is important here because you can see the totality of what's happening. He's not just going on this trip with his sons and leaving the wives and leaving the daughters and leaving the livestock. Everything. Everything is coming. We're all going. The seed, the promised seed, we're all moving. And it's interesting, even in verse 6, where it says all his descendants, and at the end of verse 7, all his descendants, the other word that could be used here in some translations is seed. All his seed. We're all going. So the seed is moving, and it's moving to Egypt. Now, verse 8, now these are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. So the seed is on the move, and before Moses continues the story to show us what happens, he pauses, and he's almost giving us like a before, right? I told y'all I'm going to make you a great nation. I said now I'm going to make you a great nation in Egypt. So let's almost do a snapshot in time to see what's the nation look like right now. So he gives us this little genealogy. We're not going to go through every single piece of it. Let me show you a few things. Number one, this genealogy, it's ordered based on the wives. Remember, Jacob has four wives. If you look down at verse 15, you will see it says, these are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Padan Aram with his daughter Dinah, all his sons and daughters, numbered 33. So everybody before this verse are the sons of Leah. Remember, Leah was the unloved wife, the wife that Jacob did not want. He wanted Rachel, her sister. So Leah ultimately has 33 people to her name. Then we go down to verse 18. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Leah, and she bore to Jacob these 16 persons. So Leah has 33, Zilpah has 16. The next verse, the sons of Jacob's wife Rachel, says Joseph and Benjamin. And then if we keep going down to verse 22, it repeats Rachel. These are the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob. They were 14 persons in all. So we're kind of getting a tally going. We go down to verse 25. These are the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Rachel. 7 persons in all. So this is a little summary of who's all going down here. And I think the key verse I want you to see is at the end of it, verse 27. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. And I think that's what the point of this here is. We're doing a tally ahead of time. God promised he's going to make us a great nation. Where do we stand right now? We're at 70 people. 70 people. Now, the wives are not included in this, so it's technically a little bit more than 70. But you can see Jacob had 12 sons. So he goes from one man to 12. That's okay. Now they go from 12 to 70. And technically a little more than 70. You can see the family's growing. But this is not yet the multiplication that we're going to see in a little bit. Okay, so we do the tally, and now they get to Egypt. Verse 28. Now he, which is Jacob, he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. So again, Judah, here he is. He's a leader. His father is saying, hey, Judah, we're almost to Egypt. Go to Joseph and tell him where we need to go. And they go to the land of Goshen. And in verse 29, and we have another image for this of this reunion, verse 29 says, Joseph prepared his chariot, and he went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck, and he wept on his neck a long time. We got to remember the last time that Jacob and Joseph saw each other was 22 years ago. 22 years. And we saw last time where Jacob believes, wow, my son's alive? And you see his spirits revive. But here they're finally meeting. I thought this was an interesting picture. You can see it's Joseph. It's a little different rendition from typical Egyptian. But you see Joseph, and he's hugging his father. I thought it's interesting just that we see, in my mind, it's like just the two of them, you know? But it's like the whole clan is here. The whole family's rolling up to Goshen. And Joseph comes in, and he's on his chariot. He's showing his father, like, look kind of what's become of me. And his father and Joseph embrace each other. This is 22 years of each of them wondering what's going on. Jacob is wondering, is my son, I believe he's dead. And Joseph's wondering, is my father alive? Joseph's about 40 at this point. Jacob's 130. And so they have this reunion. And the picture that comes to my mind, this is like if you've seen those videos, or maybe you've experienced this personally, of like a man or woman coming back from the army or something, from the military, and they haven't seen their family, you know, and then they're just hugging each other so tight. That's the kind of emotion I feel here. But I think it's even more than that. Because in that situation, mostly the time, you know, you're being some communication, you know the status of the person. But this situation has been 20 years of Jacob believing my son is dead. So that's like parents of a military person receiving a letter saying he's dead. And now they've been believing that for 20 years. And now he comes back. And now they finally embrace. So Jacob and his son finally have their reunion. And not only was this a reunion, this is also a confirmation of God's promised blessing. Remember, in the very beginning of this story, God gave Joseph these dreams, saying, your brothers are going to bow down to you. And then the other one said, your father's going to bow down to you. And remember, Jacob said he kept this saying in mind. He's like, what is up with this? And when he finds out his son's dead, he's thinking, oh, maybe that was wrong. Well, now he finds out, oh, no, God was right all along. So they have their reunion. They finally make it to Egypt. And now he's concerned to make sure that he provides for his family. The famine is still going on. And so Joseph wants to make sure that they have good, safe land, and he knows just how to get it. So let's continue in verse 31. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household, who were in the land of Canaan, have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they've been keepers of livestock, and they've brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? You shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen. And notice this, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. So they're going to get the land called Goshen. It was in the first picture, but it's near the delta portion in Egypt. It's the fertile land. Joseph knows this area. He knows that's the land that they want, especially as shepherds. He also knows that this land is going to be good. It's going to keep them separate from Egypt. They're going to be there. He's going to provide for them, but it's going to keep them separate enough. And that's what he's getting at when he says, I'm going to go tell Pharaoh, my brothers are here, they're shepherds. He says at the very end of that, every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. And we actually heard that word previously. You remember where we heard about loathsome? Maybe not. When the brothers come to Joseph the second time and they have dinner with him or lunch with him, they have to sit at different tables because the Israelites are loathsome to the Egyptians. So what I think is interesting that Joseph's doing here is he knows if we say that we're shepherds, which we are, it will allow us to be in the land but be separate, because being intermixed with people has been a trouble this whole time in the story. So now they're going to be separate. And so we see what happens. We pick it up in chapter 47. Then Joseph went and he told Pharaoh. So he's doing the plan. And he said, my father and my brothers and their flocks and herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan. Behold, they're in the land of Goshen. He took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, what's your occupation? So they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers. And they said to Pharaoh, we've come to sojourn in the land, for there's no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And look at this. And if you know any capable men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. So they get the best of the land, and they get some jobs out of it. So Joseph presents his brothers, a few of them, five of them. Some commentators say maybe it's the most impressive of the brothers. Let's let these five be the ones that Pharaoh sees. And Pharaoh agrees to the plan, so now they got land. And now he's presented his brothers, and look in verse 7, now he's going to present his father. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. Notice this, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now that's interesting, and we have, I believe, an image for this as well. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Now we have to understand, this is not just two men standing there. And before here, we have two nations. Pharaoh is the head of Egypt. And Jacob, though he doesn't seem like it with only 70 peoples to his name, he, at this time, is the leader of the tribes. So it's not just two men standing here. We have the representatives of two nations. But what's interesting is the contrast. Pharaoh, he's probably younger. He's stronger. He's got the wealth. Jacob's 130. He's weak and frail, and he's so impoverished because of this famine, he's probably doesn't have a lot to his name. Yet, the weaker one is blessing the stronger. Jacob is the one who blesses Pharaoh. Usually it's the more distinguished of the people who gives the blessing, but Jacob's giving the blessing. And I like how one source says, this section climaxes with the impoverished and aged Jacob blessing the all-powerful Pharaoh. A discreet reminder that blessing comes from God through his chosen mediator, not through the power that human beings acquire. We're getting a little taste of that fulfillment in Genesis 12. I will bless those who bless you. So Jacob blesses Pharaoh, and then in verse 8, Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? Kind of an inappropriate question. So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. And look what he says, few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So he says, the years of my sojourning. Sojourning is like he's my wandering around. I'm traveling from place to place. I'm not fixed anywhere. He says there are 130. But I think Jacob's view of this is good. He's viewing his life like he's on a sojourn. It's a camping trip, I've heard a commentator say. It's like he's on a camping trip. And this is what the New Testament encourages us. Peter encourages us to consider ourselves strangers and aliens right now where we are. Right? Don't get too comfortable because this is not your home. Peter also says, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay on earth. Right? As believers, we understand that this is not everything. And this is not our ultimate home. And so you see Jacob saying, my sojourning, I've been alive for 130 years. And he says these years have been few and unpleasant. Now, to our ears, 130 is not few. But he's comparing himself to his father and his grandfather. Isaac, does anybody know how old Isaac was? Take a guess.
175.
That's a good guess. 180. And Abraham, 175. Maybe it's somewhere in there. So Isaac and Abraham are both past 170. Jacob's 130. He's going to live longer than this, though, but he knows my time's coming short. I've not lived nearly like my father or my grandfather. And he says, few and unpleasant have been the years of my life. You know, I was studying this, and I just was thinking about, it kind of sounds like a downer right now, Jacob. You just saw your son, like, what's going on? But when you really think about his life, Jacob's had a hard life. He has not had an easy go of it. And a lot of the difficulty was self-induced. Jacob received the blessing. God, when Jacob and Esau were in the womb, God said, the younger is going to be over the older. Right? That's Jacob. But what does Jacob do? He doesn't trust in God's promise. He doesn't let God bring that about in his way. Jacob and his mother deceive his father Isaac. They take man's way to try to get this thing. And I kind of consider that the first domino in the whole chain for Jacob. Because when he deceives his father, he now is hated by his brother, and he has to leave, and he has to flee from his family. And he flees from his family, and he goes to his uncle far away. His name is Laban. And Jacob reaps what he sows because Laban tricks him to marrying the wrong wife. And this continues now. He's got multiple wives. He's got issues. The siblings are having rivalry. They sell Joseph. And then the sons come and deceive their own father. The deception continues. So Jacob has not had an easy go of it. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life. And it says in verse 10, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. Verse 11, so Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had ordered. Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food according to their little ones. So he presents his brothers, he presents his father, Pharaoh agrees, now they got land, they got a place to stay, and now Joseph makes sure my family's going to have food. They're still in the famine. They got land and they're going to have food. But notice, we're not going to read all this, but look at verse 13. Now there was no food in all the land because the famine was very severe. So the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. So what I think Moses is doing here, we're going to see this contrast. Joseph is taking care of his family. They're provided for. What we're going to see is the people in the land of Egypt are so famished and running out of resources. They've already used all their money to buy grain. What they then do is they go to Joseph and they say, we've run out of money. We'll have to give you our livestock in exchange for grain. So they sell Joseph in exchange. They give him their cattle and their sheep and all that. But then it keeps saying, the next year, the famine is still so severe, they have to come back. So now they have no money, no animals, and they tell Joseph, buy us and buy our land. We got nothing left. Look at verse 19. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate. So they are so impoverished that they literally are willing to give themselves and their land up. Joseph agrees. He basically buys their land and lets them live as tenants to work it. And then he gives them 4/5 of their produce to keep and says, you got to give a fifth to Pharaoh. Now, some commentators, they kind of get on Joseph, like, why is he doing this? This is so oppressive. But a good principle in Bible study is you have to let the text speak for itself. Look at verse 25. Here's what the people say. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves. Now, clearly, they're not happy to be slaves, but they're saying, the alternative is we die. You've saved us and our little ones. So I think this is interesting to note here that Joseph is able to provide for his family, and Joseph is able to provide for the people of Egypt. We're seeing God, his blessings working here. God blessed and provides for his people. God blessed and provides for Pharaoh. And then he saves the multitude in Egypt through Joseph. Here's how Alan Ross writes, God blessed his people according to the promise he made to Abraham. But notice, moreover, God blessed Pharaoh because he had blessed the seed of Abraham with the best of Egypt. So basically all I'm getting at is Pharaoh said, y'all can have the best of the land. Go to the best of the land. And in turn, remember, who blesses you will be blessed. Now Pharaoh, through Joseph, acquires all the rest of the land of Egypt and all the livestock and all the people. He's being blessed because he's blessing God's chosen people. We continue in verse 27. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt, in Goshen, and they acquired property in it. And notice this, and they were fruitful, and they became very numerous. Now, this is one of these times when you're studying the Bible, you could like blow past this. You don't notice anything, you just keep going. But when you study and you slow down, and you realize, I've heard this before, fruitful and numerous. But here's what I stumbled upon that really blew my mind is this. Multiple times throughout the book of Genesis, God talks about being fruitful and multiplying. But at first, he's commanding people. He's telling Adam and Eve, he says, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. He's commanding them, do this, be fruitful. Then he commands Noah. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. He's telling them, commanding them, go do this. But then throughout Genesis, it changes from a command to a promise. In chapter 17 to Abraham, he says, God will multiply you exceedingly. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you. In chapter 22 to Abraham, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of heaven and the sand on the seashore. Chapter 26, promising Isaac, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. I will bless you and multiply your descendants. In 28, Isaac's telling his son, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply. And then we get one more command in 35 to Jacob, be fruitful and multiply. And then after all this time, he's commanding them, he's promising them, but it hasn't happened yet. And finally, in the land of Egypt, they were fruitful and multiplied. They were. The promise is coming to a fulfillment. What began as a command to Adam transformed into a promise to Abraham and has now become a reality under Joseph. They're finally fruitful and have become very numerous. And the other thing that really strikes me here, y'all can tell me if you think this is interesting or if I'm just going too deep on this, but it strikes me that I keep telling y'all that in the land they had all these threats. There's always threats in the land. There's always things threatening the seed. You had violence, right? Abraham has to go save his nephew Lot from these kings. Jacob's nervous because his two sons go wild and they kill all these people, and now he's thinking they're going to come kill us. There's violence in the land. You've got foreign people. The sons are intermarrying with Canaanite women. You got all these issues going on in the land. You've got famines that they don't have any way to control. And so typically we think of the story as God protected Jacob and his family from this big famine. But as I was studying, I realized not only was God just protecting them from the famine, God was using the famine to move them to Egypt. Do you kind of see what I'm getting at? Not just, oh, I'm protecting them from it. I'm using this. I need to protect them. They're a young nation. They're weak. They can't defend themselves. There's too many threats in the land. I need to get them somewhere where they can be isolated. Remember, the Hebrews, they think the Egyptians think the Hebrews are loathsome. They don't want to mess with these people. Finally, they're now isolated in the land of Egypt. And you know what this means? Egypt now becomes the womb for the birth of the nation. The time in Egypt is not an interruption of the covenant, but an incubation of the covenant people. Am I the only one who thinks this is amazing? This is me? Okay. And then verse 28, we find out Jacob lives in the land of Egypt 17 years. The length of Jacob's life was 147. So he started, we said he was 130 previously, and now he makes it to 147. Verse 29, when the time for Israel, this is Jacob, to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and he said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of his bed. So they've made it to Egypt. They're safe. They have land. They were going to become numerous. But Jacob knows that this is not our home. We're here. God's doing this on purpose so we can become this nation, but this is not our home. And you can see Jacob's faith. He tells his son Joseph, do not bury me here. Don't leave my body in Egypt. You have to bring me back to Canaan. And doesn't that just show his faith in God's promise? He keeps telling us. He told me before, when I was at Beersheba offering sacrifices, he told me, I will bring y'all back. And so he says, do not leave me here. Swear to me that you will bring me back. And then at the end in verse 31, I find this interesting. He said, swear to me. So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed and worshipped at the head of his bed. Some translations say Israel worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. It's kind of the two translations of this. A little different, each of them, but I think the same concept's being communicated. the term bow down or worshiped is here. Now, here's what I find fascinating. We keep hearing this term bow down. And this term worship, when I look up the word, it's the same word as bow down. So it kind of actually depends on the context. Are we bowing down to a person, or are we worshiping the Lord? And the book of Hebrews refers to this, and Hebrews says Israel worshipped as he leaned on his staff. So we don't want to go too far in our interpretation, but I can't get away from the fact that I find it interesting that now Jacob is bowing down and his son is standing there. And we've seen that before as well. Okay, so they've made it to the land. He says, please do not leave me here. You got to bring my body up. And Jacob, it's like he's clinging on for dear life because he keeps saying he's about to die, but he keeps on going. Chapter 48, look at this now. He's going to bless Joseph's sons. Now, it came about after these things that Joseph was told, behold, your father is sick. So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. When it was told Jacob, behold, your son Joseph has come to you, Israel collected his strength, and he sat up in bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me. And he said to me, behold, I'll make you fruitful and numerous, and I'll make you a company and a people, and give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. Okay, so basically, Joseph finds out my father's sick. He's going to die soon. He brings his sons to him. Now, what's interesting is this. Look at verse 5. Now, your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. Now, this is amazing if you understand what just happened. Jacob just told Joseph that your two sons are going to have the same place of inheritance as the 12, as the other 12. I'm going to elevate them. So now his two sons get a prominent position in the family. And actually, in 1 Chronicles 5, we learn that the birthright that should go to Reuben, the firstborn, is taken away from him and given to Joseph. We're going to find out why in a little bit. So now Joseph and his sons receive the birthright, and they are considered as part of the 12 tribes. And this will help you as you're studying the Bible later on, because you'll read stuff about the 12 tribes. And sometimes it'll say Joseph, and sometimes it says Ephraim and Manasseh. And you're like, what is going on here? It's the same thing. They've been elevated in status. But this gets even crazier, because if you go to verse 13 now, in chapter 48, look what it says. So Joseph takes his boys, Ephraim with his right hand, toward Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, and he brought them close to him. So let me help you see this. Joseph has his sons. He brings his sons, and he's facing his father. And so his father has his right hand here and his left hand here. And the right hand is the hand that he's going to give the big blessing, right? And so what Jacob does, or where are we at now? We're at Joseph. Yeah, Joseph. He takes his eldest son in his left hand and moves him towards his father's right. And he takes his younger and moves him towards his father's left. But you know what's interesting? The text tells us Jacob he's dim of seeing. He can't see, just like his father Isaac. And so here's what happens. As he's getting ready to give the blessing to the firstborn and the secondborn, you know what Jacob does? He switches. He crosses his hands.
Jacob.
Jacob crosses his hands on Joseph's sons. So he's putting his right hand on the younger son and his left hand on the older. And I'm thinking, if you're Joseph, you're like, what is going on? And you see this reaction. Look at verse 17. When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, and he also will be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he. And so it continues. Alan Rossi says this, Joseph, like so many others, expected God to work in a certain way. But he found that God is often pleased to work differently and even unconventionally. But faith recognizes that God's ways are not man's ways. It took Jacob a lifetime of discipline to learn that fact. Jacob's the one giving the blessing. But he learned it, and now he blesses the younger over the elder. For four consecutive generations, this reversed pattern was followed. Isaac over Ishmael, Jacob over Esau, Joseph over Reuben, and Ephraim over Manasseh. I said we're going to have some twists and turns, and that was one of them. And look, we see this other times in the Bible. Think about King David. Remember David? Samuel goes to David's father, Jesse, and says, I'm going to anoint one of your sons. And what does Jesse do? He brings out seven of his sons, and he puts them in order, and Samuel, the prophet, he's standing before Eliab, the eldest, and he's looking at him, he said, surely this is the guy. But what does God say? That's not the guy. And he goes to the next son. Sure, this has got to be not the guy. And he goes down the line. He gets through all the sons. And he tells Jesse, something's off here. God's saying none of these are the sons. Do you have any other sons? And Jesse's like, wait, you talking about that shepherd boy? Yes, that's exactly who I'm talking about. And so Ephraim receives the blessing before Manasseh. And if you continue to study the Bible, you learn that Ephraim, he becomes a leading tribe in the northern kingdom, much superior to his little brother Manasseh. Now, we're going to keep going, but before we leave 48, I do just want to bring your attention to one other verse that I think is just so beautiful. Look at verse 15 in the middle of this. This is right where Jacob's going to bless the sons. Verse 15, he says this. He blessed Joseph, which is him saying, I'm blessing you, Joseph, and your sons. And he says, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked. Right? So he's describing God. And look at how he describes God in the next part of that verse. The God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. Saint, this is beautiful. This is the same man who said, my years have been few and unpleasant. But he's saying, God, despite my bad choices, despite the trials that I brought upon myself, he has been my shepherd this whole time. He has graciously blessed me far beyond I deserve. He has been my shepherd. And this is actually the first mention of God as a shepherd in the Bible. The Lord is my shepherd. Okay. Let's continue in chapter 49. So we've seen Jacob blesses two of Joseph's sons. Well, guess what? Now Jacob's going to bless the rest of the sons. We're coming to a close here. We're coming into the station, so bear with me. Look at 49, verse 1. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father. I think we have another image of this. So now he's blessed Joseph's sons, and now it's time to bless the 12. Jacob's on his last leg. He's close to dying, and it's time to say, what's going to happen to each of you 12? We're not going to look at all of them, but we'll look at a few. Look at verse 3. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. However, it says, uncontrollable as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it, he went up to my couch. Do we know what this is talking about? Reuben the firstborn? Remember earlier I said he loses his birthright status. The reason is because Reuben the firstborn, at some point in this story, he sleeps with one of Jacob's wives. He's got the four. He sleeps with one of them, defiles his father's bed, and for that reason, forever it is put down. You are preeminent in dignity and power, but you are uncontrollable as water, like boiling water. So he loses his leadership and his firstborn inheritance. Okay, we're not starting good. Let's see how Simeon and Levi do. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Okay, we're three for three. So Simeon and Levi don't exactly get a blessing here for their uncontrollable anger. And again, we told the story back in Genesis 34 of when their sister was defiled by a man in the land that they were in. And Simeon and Levi were the brothers. Instead of dealing with this in an appropriate manner, they went into that city and they slaughtered every male. Every one of them. And so Jacob is remembering this here, and he's saying, verse 6, let my soul not enter into their counsel, meaning I had no clue about these plans. I was not aware of this. I didn't approve of this. And so his pronouncement on them is in verse 7, cursed be their anger for its fierce and their wrath for its cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And as you come to find out, Simeon and Levi have very small portions of land when it comes to the land that's allocated. Simeon gets some scattered villages. Levi ends up, his tribe ends up being distributed because they become the priests. But they just have little bitty parts of land all throughout. They don't ever have one big part of land together. So it's not going well. If you're the next son in line, you're probably thinking, maybe we can give Dad lunch or something before he gets to me. The next one up is Judah. Judah, here we go. We've been following Judah this whole time. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He dashes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk. Okay, Judah gets it now. Notice this, how interesting in verse 8. Your father's son shall bow down to you. This whole time we talk about bowing down, we talk about Joseph. And now at the very end, Judah. The one who started so low, and he's been building it himself, his character over time, and now we see that he gets the same level of prominence in a sense. Judah's going to have leadership. Your brothers will bow down to you now. And then we see he's like a lion. As a lion, who dares rouse him up? Judah will be mighty. His tribe will be a mighty tribe. And then the infamous, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. You know what this is talking about? Kings are going to come from Judah. And the line, the kings will not depart from Judah. And the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Scepter is a symbol of kingship. But this is not just pointing to anything normal. This is pointing to the coming king, particularly King David, and ultimately King Jesus. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. How amazing that the Messiah is going to come from the line of a man with such low beginnings. Okay, now come with me to verse 22. Now let's just get to Joseph. How are we going to do with him? So we start off, we see a little bit of Joseph's bio, and then we see his blessings. 22 says, Joseph is a fruitful bough, or some translations say son, a fruitful bough by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm, and his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is a shepherd, the stone of Israel, from the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you. So he starts off kind of reiterating, Joseph is fruitful, and he's hated for it. The archers attack him, like his brothers, they're attacking him, yet he remains agile and firm, and God defends him. And so he gives a little bit of a biography of Joseph, but then look at the blessings he heaps on him in verse 25 and on. From the God of your fathers who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above and blessings of the deep that lie beneath and blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bounds of the everlasting hills may they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Joseph is blessed. Abundant blessing. One of the commentators, in short, the blessing on Joseph would be so great it would exceed anything that one could imagine from a very fertile land. Okay, so Jacob's closing out here. He's blessed the sons. Verse 28, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, everyone, with the blessing appropriate to him. And then we find out he tells them something similar. He says, do not let me be buried in Egypt. Take me to Canaan. And then verse 33, when Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into bed, and he breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Jacob's death. How amazing that his death ends. He ends his life with the promises of God still on his tongue. Don't let me be buried here. Bring me to Canaan. God promised it. I believe it. Bury me there. And verse, in chapter 50, verse 1, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. He's just closed his father's eyes and he's weeping over him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel, and 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And so they embalm him, and then they follow what he says. And Joseph and his brothers and the Egyptians, a huge party of them, they get permission from Pharaoh, and they take the body of Jacob, and they go all the way back to Canaan, and they bury him in Canaan in the same burial plot that Abraham was buried in and that Isaac was buried in. It's such a huge procession of people that in verse 11, when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. They think this is an Egyptian thing. They're saying, wow, I don't know who that man was, but there are a lot of people mourning him. And now, just at the end, when we think we're done with the twists and turns, look at verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for the wrong we did to him? So they sent him a message to Joseph saying, your father charged us before he died, saying, you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgressions of your servants of the God of your father. And look at Joseph's reaction. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. He's like, have you not let this go? I surely had the chance to do what I needed to do when y'all first came here. I forgave you. They don't believe it, maybe, or maybe there's a little distrust, or I have not experienced this, but apparently when parents in a family die, that's maybe a time when the sibling rivalry kind of stirs back up, you know? The parents are out of the way. Maybe they're the ones keeping it in check, and they're thinking, has he really forgiven us, or is this going to come back up again? But look, here's the climax here. Look at verse 19. Here's how Joseph responds. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid. Am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them, and he spoke kindly to them. This is the final little test. The father's out the way. Remember, Esau and Jacob, when Jacob deceived his father, Esau said, as soon as my father dies, I'm going to get him. Maybe he was peaceable until, but once my father's dead, I'm going to get him. And here's Joseph's final test, and he passes with flying colors. He knows Romans 12, 9 through 21. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink, for in doing so, you'll heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Joseph understands God's providence. He understands God worked this. What they did was evil. It was very evil. But God worked that evil for good. And because he understands that, he is able to finally, totally forgive them and even provide for them. And now at the end, verse 22, now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. So it's interesting. I mean, we like have been zoomed in on 22 years of Joseph's life over the last chapters, and then in a flash, we just zoom forward 60 years or something to he's 110. You know, we just zoom through it, and it's like the silent years of Joseph. And it kind of sounds like he's just living a good life. He's got his family back. He's got sons and grandsons and great-grandsons that he's with. You think maybe this is the end of the story. Maybe he's getting comfortable. Finally, he's comfortable in Egypt. He's not comfortable in Egypt. He remembers the promises of God. Look what he says in verse 24. Joseph said to his brothers, he's 110, "I am about to die. But God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here." So Joseph died at the age of 110, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Egypt was never his home. Never. He spent his whole life there once he was sold there, but he knows his home. It's the place where God promised. And even on his dying breath, that promise is still on his lips. They put his coffin in Egypt, but he says, "Bring my bones up from here." And then later on, I have to find where, but they actually accomplished this. I'd have to figure out what the reference is. They bring his bones all the way back up, back to the land of Canaan. So Abraham died looking towards God's promises. Isaac died looking towards God's promises, and now Jacob and his son Joseph, they die having seen partial fulfillment of the promise of seed and the promise of blessing, and now they're looking forward in faith to the promised land. And as I just reflect on this, and I was thinking, like, what's a good takeaway, how can we apply this to our lives? I was kind of stunned by how much these five chapters talked about this promise of a land. There's a land. We're supposed to go to a land. God has promised it. And so the passage, come with me, we can end here, is in John 14. These men are obsessed with the promises of God. They're obsessed with the fact that God has promised things and he's going to do it. And so the verse that came to mind is in John 14, Jesus talking to his disciples the night before he's going to die. He gives them a promise, and that promise is one that we must hold on to. In John 14, here's what Jesus says. "Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. For I go to prepare a place for you." And here it is. "If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." That's a promise on the mouth of Jesus. And that is the promised land that we should all fix our eyes on. All right, let's pray. What a wonderful story, Lord. What a wonderful piece of history. How grateful are we that you have preserved this in your word, that we get to study it and benefit from it, Lord. I pray that you help us as we go through the story and we think about it. We see your providence. When the world seems totally chaotic and when our own individual lives seem out of control, God, you are still working. Help us, like Joseph, to believe that you can work through this, Lord, and you can work all things for our good, even if they don't seem good. And Father, help us to trust your promises. You have shown that you go to great lengths to keep your word. And these men believe it. Please help us to believe it too, Lord, and trust you that when you say something, you will do it. We thank you for this time. In your name we pray. Amen.